Okay, well, George Loewenjoe was born in 1885 to a thoroughly bourgeois, wealthy family, and his father, Joseph, was director of the General Credit Bank of Hungary. And so the George that we know and are going to talk about became George von Lukács when his father was ennobled, or he made a noble, and given the name von Lukács. And his early writings, of George are under the name George von Lukács. Now, George Lukács was inspired at the time of the Russian Revolution, which he described as a window into the future. And he joined the Hungarian Communist Party in December 1918, but he was only associated with genuine revolutionary Marxism for a brief 10 years. And by 1929, he'd accommodated to Stalin, and he retreated into literary criticism and academic philosophy, for which he's mostly known. So a lot of what's written about him on the internet and that I found doesn't even mention the fact that he was a commissar in the Hungarian Soviet government of 1919, and he was also a political commissar in their Red Army. But in 1956, he did support the Hungarian uprising against the Stalinist state. He joined the Nozh government briefly before the USSR sent in the tanks. By the late 1960s, with the revival of mass struggle, he began to openly criticise and oppose the regimes of Eastern Europe. And some of the last words that he wrote before his death in 1969 were, "Both systems in crisis, authentic Marxism, the only solution." Now, between 1918 and 1926, in his period as a genuine Marxist, Lukács produced a trilogy in which he provided what I'd argue is a philosophical restatement of some of Marx's most important ideas. And the trilogy consists of History and Class Consciousness, which we are selling, which is an exposition of commodity fetishism and alienation, which provides a materialist explanation of why workers accept capitalist ideas and how they can break with them. The second was Lenin, A Study in the Unity of His Thought, just a small book, which unfortunately we don't have copies of this weekend, but we usually sell it. It was written soon after Lenin's death in 1924, and it's a philosophical argument for a revolutionary party along the lines that Lenin built. And then in 1926, under fire from Stalin's cronies, he wrote in defence of History and Class Consciousness, Taylorism and the Dialectic. And we do have copies of that on the bookstall. And this was a restatement of the principles argued in the first two books. But actually, it's quite a good summary. It clarifies the arguments and consolidates what is one of the high points of Marxist intervention into philosophy. Now, History and Class Consciousness was published in English for the first time in 1971, and it was an inspiration to young revolutionaries at the time. Chris Harman, the British Marxist from that generation, wrote, "History and Class Consciousness was a philosophical clarion call, echoing over the years since the early Communist International to a new generation of revolutionaries trying to find their way to a Marxism free from Stalinist distortions." Jim Wolfries, another British Marxist in the SWP in Britain, reviewed In Defence of History and Class Consciousness when it was published in English for the first time in 2000. And he summed up why it was important in similar terms. He said, "It represents from beyond the grave a valuable tool for those seeking to pick up the thread of authentic Marxism broken by Stalin in the 1920s. Now, Lukács' philosophical defence of Marxism, I think, is important because at some point it can again play a very crucial role in convincing a new layer of students and intellectuals in this century. And I'll argue also that his life and his politics illustrate the argument that he so well makes in his second book, that a revolutionary vanguard party needs to be built before and in preparation for revolution. Now, there's a lot written about Lukács, about how he became a Marxist. And so I want to say a few things about his life before 1918. He was a Hungarian, but in both Germany and Hungary, both of them were late developing capitalism with a cowardly, weak bourgeoisie similar to Russia. And so there were a whole layer of young intellectuals that felt alienated, well, not all that young, influenced by anti-feudal Jacobinism and also romantic anti-capitalism. And Lukács was associated from about 1906 with Max Weber's Heidelberg Circle and other intellectuals in Germany, and then he was part of what became known as the Sunday Circle in Hungary. And this consisted of a milieu of poets, artists, writers, academics who met regularly to discuss philosophical ideas, and included people like Thomas Mann, the novelist, whose books I notice are in great number in Borders still, George Simmel, Robert Michel, who was then a syndicalist, the pacifist poet Ernst Toller, the future Kierkegaardian philosopher Karl Jasper, the composer Bela Bartok, and the Dostoevsky admirer Ernst Bloch. And along with Dostoevsky, Tolstoy's pacifism and Nietzsche's irrationalism were influential amongst these intellectuals. And the Hungarian group, though, was influenced by the revolutionary syndicalist Ervin Szabo and the revolutionary poet André Ady. And probably I'd argue this was the reason that most of them went over to communism in 1918, unlike the members of Weber's circles. Now, André Ady, with a poet's lyrical genius, expressed his ideas of the coming revolution, or at least the revolution that he yearned for, in terms very similar to what Trotsky was arguing about permanent revolution. Ady was writing about that as early as 1903. And in a remarkable essay titled Earthquake After the 1905 Revolution in Russia, he wrote, "Russia is carrying out two revolutions at once, the old one, which Europe has already experienced, and a new one. Russian democracy is triumphantly shaking the throne by means of blood, rubble, and ashes. History will be proud of this formidable earthquake. Here we have the proletariat giving the people back to the people." And the essay ends, "Rotten and impotent societies can be saved only by the people, the working people, invincible and irresistible." Now, feeling isolated and smothered by backward Hungary and the ultra-conservative Social Democratic Party, who made the Mensheviks look like revolutionaries, the radical intellectuals in Hungary, they just felt alienated, angry and frozen. And Lukács was part of this, and he glimpsed in André Ady's poetry the passion and the tragedy of what he called the revolutionary in Hungary, which he referred to, and partly referring to himself as much as anyone, as when he wrote of Ady that he was the poet of the Hungarian revolutionaries without a revolution. His audience is pathetically grotesque. He added, "There is a need for revolution, but it is an impossible hope. There would be only leaders." And the mood was summed up in Ady's Psalm of Blessed Impossibility. It goes, "Since I expect what cannot be had, expect only what cannot be had. Oh, I suffer the most bloody of bloody tortures. My brain is dizzy, my throat is hoarse, and borne down by the demented twilight, oh, blessed, accursed impossibility, I intone thy consuming song." Which I think sums up their mood a bit. Now, Michael Lowy, the Trotskyist biographer of Lukács, he sums up the effect of the Russian Revolution that it had on the Sunday Circle in Hungary. He says, "Their bitter, anguished despair was transformed through a brilliant explosion into immense, passionate and messianic hope." And Lukács himself later wrote that he and his philosophical circle saw at last a way for mankind to escape war and capitalism. Now, the talk of explosions and ruptures is what you always read when you read these accounts. I think it makes it sound as if Lukács leapt from a bourgeois intellectual to a revolutionary in the interval between two Sundays, as one of his friends put it, after he met Bela Kun, who'd come back from Russia as a prisoner of war and been convinced of the Bolsheviks' politics. And he'd founded the Communist Party on the 20th of November 1918, and Lukács joined 2 weeks later. But it was important that Lukács had already read Marx while he was at school, and then when war broke out, he returned to Marx and began to see that Marx's economic analysis of capitalism had provided a framework for understanding the whole of capitalist society and its superstructure, and he was also impressed by Rosa Luxemburg's economic writings that he read. Now, and Lukács' tragic worldview had been rooted in the belief that there was no way out of the society and that he and others so hated. He said many years later, "The Russian Revolution was the world historical solution to my dilemma." And his last hesitations were expressed in an essay, "Bolshevism as a Moral Problem," which he was to dismiss in 1967 as a disguised apologia fortified with abstract and philistine arguments. So let's look at Lukács' contribution to Marxist philosophy. Now, Marx and Engels had written in the German Ideology, "The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, i.e. the class which has the means of material production at its disposal consequently also controls the means of mental production, so that the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are, on the whole, subject to it." Now, this is what most people think, but it's actually not a sufficient explanation of why workers accept ideas that are contrary to their own interests. Why do capitalist ideas find any resonance amongst workers? And Lukács, following Marx, grounded his explanation in the material reality of the structures of capitalism. They both argued that capitalism is a system of commodity production, and unlike previous class societies, workers have no control over their labour or over any means of production. And an essential point in the argument is that the fact that labour power, our ability to work, is a commodity on the market. And this induces in workers the sense that they're individual atoms whose fate is subject to the market over which they have no control. And it seems as if we're just powerless. We're dominated by the market, the state, and capitalist industry. And it's this sense of powerlessness that Marx called alienation. And this alienation arises directly from the point of production. But on a society-wide level, the generalised exchange of commodities means that human relations, such as producing whatever you need yourself or what others might need, where, you know, you can see who's contributing what to society, all of this is replaced by relations between things. Like, for instance, who knows who produced all this equipment here or our books or the food we're eating. And I ended up deciding I'd actually just quote Marx out of Capital because he puts it really clearly. He says, "The relation of the producers to the sum total of their own labour is presented to them as a social relation existing not between themselves, as it would be when people produced use values, but between the products of their labour. A definite social relation between men assumes in their eyes the fantastic form of relations between things." And in Capital, Marx goes beyond this theory of, the theory of alienation that he'd outlined in earlier works, and referring to the fact that humans create gods who then dominate the humans, he discusses how the market and the commodities sold on it, while created by humans, dominate our lives. And he says the fetishism which attaches itself to the products of labour, he says, obscures the fact that society and its institutions are just as much the products of humans as linen, flax, etc. And he argued that the point of looking at this is that it makes it very difficult to see how the system works. And the ideological effects of this Marx called commodity fetishism. Now, Lukács called all of this a process of reification. And he showed, following Marx, that alienation and commodity fetishism are separate phenomena, but they're both rooted in the material circumstances of generalised commodity production, and therefore they're dialectically related. He said there's both an objective and a subjective side to this phenomena. Objectively, a world of objects and relations between things springs into being, the world of commodities and their movements on the market. The laws governing these objects are indeed gradually discovered by man, but even so they confront him as invisible forces that generate their own power. Subjectively, a man's activity becomes estranged from himself. It turns into a commodity which, subject to the non-human objectivity of the natural laws of society, must go its own way, independently of man, just like any consumer article. And so the whole point of this argument is that workers don't just accept ideas that are opposed to their class interests because they're stupid or they're uneducated. And they don't accept capitalist ideas because they're just mindless empty vessels that can be filled up with whatever tripe the capitalist class put out, or alternatively that, you know, socialists can just fill up these empty vessels with a whole lot of ideas. The ideas gain acceptance because the feelings of powerlessness give rise to passivity, to habits of deference to authority figures, and so people accept ideas that are propagated by these authority figures and their institutions. And combined with this, then, is the fact that the whole economic structure obscures the reality of how capitalism actually works. So it's very difficult to see the reality of the system. And Lukács argues, as did Marx, this process of reification affects every aspect of our lives. And, you know, that includes education, intellectual life, culture, ideas, opinion, sex, everything in society becomes a commodity. And capitalism needs a system of laws and administration which can be measured for performance, just as factory production can. And so this is the cause of bureaucracy, which means impersonal, sterile, repetitive rules and regulations remote from any real human needs and feelings. And so our thoughts, our feelings, our personal relationships are subject to this reification, and they all potentially become commodities, and really are commodities today. And Lukács takes the example of marriage and how Kant, the bourgeois philosopher, described it. Kant had said that marriage is the union of two people with a view to the mutual possession of each other's sexual attributes. If ever there was a statement of capitalist attitudes, that's it. And reification is the reason for the lack of conviction that Lukács says, promoted by the journalism profession, which Lukács labels as the most grotesque manification of reification. He said, "Here it is subjectivity itself, knowledge, temperament, and powers of expression that are reduced to an abstract mechanism functioning autonomously and divorced both from the personality of their owner and from the material and concrete nature of the subject matter in hand. The journalist's prostitution of his, and we can say her, experience and beliefs is comprehensible only as the apogee of capitalist reification." And if anyone saw John Pilger's film, I think it was the epitome of what he's talking about. He goes on to say, "The transformation of the commodity relation into a thing of ghostly objectivity cannot therefore content itself with the reduction of all objects for the gratification of human needs to commodities. It stamps its imprint upon the whole consciousness of man." Now, this philosophical intervention was happening in a particular context. Lukács was summing up his conclusions drawn from the inspiration of the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks' role in that, and then his own participation in the Hungarian Revolution of 1919. And so Lukács concluded that while this process of reification is happening, it is still the case that workers could overcome the effects of alienation and become both the object and the subject of history. Now, because of this formulation, the subject and the object of history, Lukács is often dismissed as a Hegelian idealist, and his writings are said to be abstract philosophy, which reflects his messianic search for a resolution of philosophical questions which beset him. And he's said by these critics to have no explanation of how the working class can become this subject of history. And I think it's worth mentioning, actually, that a few of the more modern of these critics are actually admirers of Althusser, including Alex Kalinikos of the British SWP, who for many years was soft on Althusser. Now, Althusser was a Stalinist for whom there is no subject in history, that humans are simply objects dominated by social structures. And I think their criticisms are quite misplaced. I think that Lukács does explain how the working class can develop class consciousness and become the subject of history. And his starting point, as it was about ideas, was the structures of capitalism and the experience of workers within it. And he says that, well, capitalism is a system of continual change. It repeatedly descends into crisis. And so this experience that, of that chaos and the crisis can begin to reveal the true nature of the system to workers. He says the structure of crisis is seen to be no more than a heightening of the degree and intensity of the daily life of bourgeois society. In its unthinking, mundane reality, it can experience a sudden dislocation because the bonds uniting its various elements and partial systems are a chance belief, are a chance affair even at their most normal. So the pretense that society is regulated by eternal iron laws is finally revealed for what it is, a pretense. And workers' position at the as the creators of profits means that there's continual conflict between them and capitalists. There's actually an objective, conflict of interest between them over things like their hours, their wages and conditions. And so whatever the ideas in workers' heads, they're continually pushed to resist the injustices that they endure. And Lukács refers repeatedly to Marx's thesis on Feuerbach, where Marx raises the question, well, if people need new ideas to build a new society, who educates the educator? And he answered the question by saying, actually, people educate themselves by revolutionising practice. And in his defence of history and class consciousness, Lukács quotes Marx from the Holy Family when Marx said, it is not a question of what this or that proletarian or even the whole proletariat at the moment regards as its aim. It is the question of what the proletariat is and what, in accordance with this being, it will historically be compelled to do. But how do workers actually become the subject of history? Well, as workers resist, they can begin to see the total picture of the way the world works, that they can discover within themselves the potential to change the course of history. And, you know, through their own actions, they can begin to tear that veil of mystification aside. And he says, by dissolving the fetishistic objects into processes that take place among men, at the conceptual level, the structure of the world of man stands revealed as a system of dynamically changing relations in which the conflicts between man and man in the class struggle, etc., are fought out. So instead of seeing everything as a relation between things in the struggle, you can actually see it as between people. He says, history is no longer an enigmatic flux to which men and things are subjected. History is, on the one hand, the product, albeit the unconscious one, of man's activity. On the other hand, it is the succession of those processes in which the forms taken by this activity and the relations of man to himself are overthrown. So workers' consciousness is shaped by two contradictory but very material experiences. Firstly, the alienation and sense of powerlessness which flows from being treated like a commodity, and secondly, the impulse to resist because they have to sell their labour power on the market. Now, this analysis is important because it forces us to focus on the class struggle, the social reality, the state of the economy, rather than an exclusive emphasis on the state of class consciousness and propaganda, as lots of people do. And it shows that ideas do not on their own drive workers' actions, but that those actions can actually at times leap ahead of their ideas. Rapidly changing attitudes can change, political or theoretical understanding can leap ahead in the struggle. Now, this seems quite uncontroversial to anyone who knows much about socialist alternatives politics, but when Lukács published History and Class Consciousness in 1924, he was subjected to a vitriolic campaign to discredit his ideas. And the question of the role of subjectivity in history was one of the main points on which Lukács was stridently attacked. And he points out that actually this attack on subjectivity is typical of when people are breaking from Marxist dialectical view of the world. And in this respect, the debates prefigure the criticisms by the Althusserians and people like Alex Kalinikos, I think, in the 1980s. So I just want to say something about them. Because they highlight the fact that the other reason to look at them is that they highlight the fact that debates which might seem very abstract can actually impact on political ideas and often begin, you know, the fight is fought out at a theoretical level. Now, two figures, Deborin, who was a former Menshevik and was now proclaiming himself to be a Bolshevik because, remember, by 1924-25, the counter-revolution is taking off. And Rudas from the Hungarian Communist Party. They led the charge, and a lot of the defence is a reply to them. And now Deverin is the clearest in the arguments. He accepts what Lukács calls the vulgar standpoint of bourgeois everyday life and science. Inflexibly and mechanically, they split subject from object. And Lukács argues that ideas and the material world, they can be separated in theory, but really only in theory. It's only in theory that we can talk of, on the one hand, an objective social situation, and on the other, to separate out the ideas of political groups, parties, of workers, you know, things like the ALP, the influence of the Greens, the level of shop steward organisation as a subjective element. But he says, in practice, the subjective is part of the objective reality that has to be taken into account. And so the social objective situation and ideas, or the subjective, both the objective and the subjective make up a dialectical whole, what Marx called the unity of the diverse. Now, so if you take today, we have a world in crisis which is creating widespread cynicism and distrust of the institutions of capitalism, but on the other hand, we have ideas such as the fact that socialism's been tried and failed, the idea that you can't win reforms in the developed world, and these and many more, plus the decline of the revolutionary left, interact with the actual pressures for people to resist. And to understand the situation, you need to see the totality of all these phenomena and how they do interact. And in spite of all these negative ideas and the weakness of the left, we've actually seen the beginnings of some resistance, of, you know, mass strikes in Europe, and now the revolutions that have broken out in the Middle East and across the north of Africa. The idea that revolt may be the best way to win reforms can actually become, you know, has become part of that reality. And so Lukács says of Deverin's position and others like him, they protest in a tone of extreme scientific indignation if an active and positive role is accorded to a subjective moment in history. And so typically, Deverin accuses Lukács of a theory of the identity of the subjective and objective. And Lukács restates what he'd written in History and Class Consciousness. Their identity, the identity between objective and subjective, is that they are moments of one and the same real historical and dialectical process. They are not just the same. And Deverin says, the sole materialist sense of this mutual influence can only be its conception in a process of labour, as a process of production, as activity, as the struggle of society with nature. And this is very important, and Lukács grabs hold of it as, now I've got him. That for Deverin, there is no class struggle, that society struggles with nature, and that's it. And what takes place within society is mere appearance or subjectivism. And as Lukács says, to put it mildly, this is a complete break with Marxism, and that was what was going on in the Third International, a break with Marxism. Now, Rudas, who had identified with the Bolsheviks in Hungary as a member of the Hungarian Communist Party, he's not as crude as Deverin. And so he says that he is a Bolshevik, but Lukács points out that his is merely a formal acknowledgement of the Leninist theory of revolution. Because Rudas, to start with, rejected any analysis that the errors of the Hungarian Communist Party, which I'm going to look at in a minute, were critical in the defeat of the Hungarian Soviet government. And as Lukács says, whether he over or underestimates the subjective moment, Rudas always carefully separates it off from the objective and guards against any regarding the two moments in their dialectical interaction. And so one of the most vicious attacks against Lukács's argument was against this argument by Lukács, that there are key moments in the process of historical development where ideas and organisation become a critical factor. Now, so Lukács outlined his argument about moments in the historical process like this. Development does not occur then as a continuous intensification in which development is favourable to the proletariat, and on the day after tomorrow the situation must be even more favourable, and so on. It means rather that at a particular point the situation demands that a decision be taken, and the day after tomorrow might be too late to make that decision. And he quotes Lenin and the things that Lenin wrote in October 1917 as example of his point. When Lenin said, remember what's happening in October 1917, history would never forgive the revolutionaries if they hesitated when today they could win, while tomorrow they could lose so much, indeed everything. And Lukács points out that Lenin's concept of the art of insurrection is based on this very same philosophical conception. And Lukács argues that the dialectical interaction that I have outlined arises exclusively in praxis. And those who stay on the abstract terrain in which subject and object are cut off from each other, if they deny praxis, they must collapse into idealism. And politically, this results in tailism, hence the title, the subtitle, Tailism and the Dialectic of the book. And tailism just means accepting the working class consciousness as it is and assuming that it will just automatically develop along with the material circumstances. And if the workers don't rise to the occasion at any point, it was not the fault of revolutionaries, it was the fault of the objective circumstances. And so it absolves revolutionaries of any responsibility to intervene, but also to take account of their own mistakes. And it leads to writing out the subjective role of organisation, which, and he quotes Lenin, who made this very point, that it's very convenient for failed revolutionaries. Now, as Lukács says, if the rigid opposition of subject and object is taken over from pure theory into practice, it abolishes praxis. It becomes a theory of tail ending. And the left variant of this, actually, is the glorification of spontaneity and a downgrading of the party. So it ends up on the similar territory to the more right-wing position. And so Lukács's insistence on the dialectical interaction of constantly changing objective reality and consciousness is the theoretical basis for the need for a revolutionary party. Now, he also raises the question of imputed consciousness, but I can see from my time notes that I'm behind time. So if people want to talk about that, I've got a couple of quotes about imputed consciousness. We can talk about it, because it's controversial apparently as well, which I hadn't realised when I first wrote the talk. Anyway, so Lukács says in the defence that the whole point of history and class consciousness was to show that Lenin's practice of building a vanguard party is actually the logical conclusion to draw from the Marxist explanation of class consciousness and its relation to objective reality. And because the party is the practice which unites subject and object. And so he says, there's no gradual, inevitable development of class consciousness of all workers without frictions and setbacks, just because people struggle, that they're still subject to all the influences of bourgeois ideas, including reformism and all the other influences on them. And so the uneven economic and social development, all the uneven experiences of workers, means that, not everyone will have the same level of consciousness. And he says, the prevailing disunity, the differing degrees of clarity and depth to be found in the consciousness of the different individuals, groups and strata of the proletariat make the organisational separation of the party from the class inevitable. Now, why should it be inevitable? Well, he says, the uneven consciousness means that if a party tries to organise the whole of the working class, it will by necessity have to relate to a very low common denominator. But what does it mean to say that the party is separate from the class? Because this is something that's used against the idea of a vanguard party, that this is a bad thing. Well, it says you need to organise the most class-conscious advanced workers, but they must constantly pay heed tactically to the level of consciousness of the largest and most retrograde sections of the masses. The Communist Party does not function as a stand-in for the proletariat, even in theory, so it's both separate from and part of the working class. He says, as the uninterrupted dialectical interaction between theory, party and class, this concentration of theory upon the immediate needs of the class does not by any means imply that the party is absorbed into the mass of the proletariat. And so the party is both the product of and the active agent in the mass movement as well. And so the party members are trained and they learn how to lead, how to recognise the true interests of the working class, the imputed consciousness comes up there, and how to fight for them by being part of the struggle. But at the same time, the actions that the revolutionaries take, the arguments they make, can influence that struggle and at key points can make the critical difference between victory and defeat. And so Lukács argues Lenin's practice of building a vanguard party dialectically united exclusive singleness of purpose and universality. And I think we have to say that Lukács actually articulated this actual theory of the party more clearly than probably anything Lenin actually wrote about it, but Lenin's practice was, you know, able to lay the basis for that. So in other words, the party is the dialectical solution to the contradiction between the more advanced class-conscious workers and the mass of less conscious, more hesitant workers. It solves the contradiction between spontaneity, the sudden mass uprisings that we're seeing at the moment, which are the hallmark of revolution, and organisation and leadership, which are often seen to be completely contradictory and irresolvable. But there's a lot more that we could say about the breadth and depth of Lukács' philosophy and his contribution to Marxism in this trilogy. And people can raise stuff in the discussion if you want, because I want to comment on Lukács' political activity during the revolution in Hungary in 1919, for a few years after that. Now, he and other members of the Hungarian Communist Party, such as Béla Kun, combined both right-wing JAGs and ultra-leftist policies. In March 1919, the Communist Party merged with that Social Democratic Party I mentioned, while Béla Kun and others were actually languishing in jail at the hands of a government in which the SDP was sitting. And this new party actually formed the government when the bourgeois regime collapsed in the face of workers' councils and a revolutionary situation and the threat of invasion by the West. And their allies, their government lasted 133 days from the 21st of March to the 1st of August before the onset of a white counter-revolution inflicted by the invading Romanian army. And as Lenin suspected it would be, the merger was a fatal mistake because it meant that the Communist Party, who were a tiny, inexperienced minority, could not play the role that the Bolsheviks did in Russia after February 1917 in leading the working class and the masses towards an understanding of the dual power and the treacherous role of the Social Democrats, and to convince workers that they themselves had to take power through their workers, peasants and soldiers' councils. But this was only part of the problem, because Béla Kun, Lukács and the other CPers rejected Lenin's policy of giving the land to the peasants. Instead, they proposed a program of collectivization, which they argued would avoid the problem of turning the peasants into a hostile property owners. Now, this was very amenable to the SDP, because what happened was the big old landowners' farms were supposedly collectivized and remained under the ownership of the old landowners. And so the result was the peasantry very quickly became very hostile. And so the government had no authority to requisition food from the countryside as the Bolsheviks had when it was necessary. And when the Romanian army marched in, and most of whom were peasants in uniform, the soldiers were, there was no example to, you know, to show them to say that they could get something out of supporting the revolution. The Red Army, established by decree on the 30th of March, was really just the old army under a new name. It was under the control of a social democrat, was backed up by commissars, most of whom were social democrats, Lukács was one, and staffed by officers of the old regime. So if ever there was a clear example that revolutionaries are not made overnight, it's these months in Hungary in 1919, because for all their heroism, their commitment to the working class revolution, of Lukács' intellectual brilliance, they failed the crucial test of practice. And Lukács supported the ultra-lefts in the Third International, who were made famous by Lenin's polemical left-wing communism and infantile disorder, when they opposed all participation in parliamentary elections. And then in exile in Vienna, Lukács also supported the ultra-left madness of the March action in Germany in 1921. Now, Lukács did take on board the arguments that Lenin made against them, But eventually he capitulated to Stalin's counter-revolution, and he justified it in philosophical jargon about reconciliation with reality. He invoked the new situation of capitalist stability and the ebb tide of revolution around Europe, which were real enough, to justify support for the reactionary idea of socialism in one country. And he thought Trotsky's efforts were pointless, and this is a mistake of monumental proportions, an absolute travesty that he dismissed Trotsky. Trotsky makes virtually exactly the same arguments defended on the same philosophical basis as Lukács about the moments of history in his little book Lessons of October, trying to defend the traditions of Bolshevism against the Stalinist counter-revolution and, you know, the whole perversion of Marxism that was going on. And, So Lukács retreats into something of the same tragic worldview that he had before, you know, in his youth, while Trotsky went on to fight Stalin and to leave a tradition that, you know, kept alive authentic Marxism. So to finish, I think we can say if there had been a revolutionary organisation in Hungary based on genuine Marxism instead of the SDP, which appeared to be the party of the proletariat, chances are some of the figures like Lukács could have been won to Marxism earlier. But in the absence of revolutionary Marxism, intellectuals like André Ady and Lukács remained under the influence of Szabo's syndicalism. But for all the problems in his politics and practice, the arguments in Lukács' trilogy of history and class consciousness, of Lenin, and his defence of the history and class consciousness, summing up as they do Lukács' conclusions from those turbulent years of 1917 to 24, are a powerful weapon in the struggle for socialism. And I think that clarion call to authentic Marxism, which inspired a layer of young revolutionaries in the 1970s, will potentially be invaluable in winning a new layer of students and intellectuals this century. But if intellectuals are to translate the philosophy into political practice, there needs to be a party which is steeped in the practice of working class struggle and which can exercise discipline over people, because no amount of philosophical brilliance saves you from the tests of practice. And so it's not just a question of being inspired by a brilliant thinker or, you know, just knowing more philosophy. It's actually a question of taking up his ideas and using them to try to build the kind of revolutionary party that Lukács argued for with such philosophical depth.